It gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, and he is Nate. And
hey, I'll call him. So 8 o'clock? Okay, Leo, I'll make sure I don't go home, but I don't want to stop in a sentence. So I don't know how this is going to go tonight. I never really plan out what I'm going to say. I just like to talk about what kind of got me here, what my experience has been through this process, and where I'm at now. So a little bit about what got me here. Alcohol wasn't one of those things that as soon as I took the first drink, I was drinking alcohol. Kind of slow on that. You know, first time I drank was 17, didn't really come from an alcoholic family, but as soon as I drank, it was kind of freeing, you know. All those insecurities that I had, you know, as a teenager, being able to talk to girls, being able to dance, all that stuff that, you know, were fearful of, I was able to do. Didn't care, you know. So I liked it. Didn't feel the need to drink every day, but, you know, when I had the opportunity to, it came on. Never really got in trouble with it until I got into early 20s. That's when I got my first DUI. Didn't think it was a big deal. My parents even told me the way I drank, saved your life. Everybody's got to go through it. Okay, cool. Get a pass on that. Not a really big deal. And that kind of continued through my 20s. I always use the excuse that this is the phase of my life. I'll go out of it. You know, but every time I drank, it was always to excess. It was always until all the alcohol in the house or the party was completely gone. If it was gone and there was a way to go get more, then I'd be willing to pay money, drive, drunk, go get it, whatever I can do to keep that party going. Didn't really get in too much trouble with the law, even though I should have probably had about 1,000 more DUIs than I actually did get. And that, I don't know, it was always fun. There was no real repercussions for my drinking other than the hangover the night before and my buddies telling me, you know, making fun of me for the stuff I did the night before. It wasn't until stuff in my life started falling apart that I started using alcohol as a way to not feel that stuff anymore. You know, without alcohol, I don't know, I just didn't want to do it. Didn't want to deal with it. We're going to help with that stuff. It's just stuff it down, ignore it, and let it fester until something happened and I blew up on somebody I cared about. Alcohol made that completely disappear for the time being. You know, when I was drunk, didn't really care about who had hurt me, who I had hurt, what was going on in my life, the bills that weren't getting paid. Nothing mattered other than that body numbing feeling that I was experiencing. Got my second DUI after I was going through a divorce. Wasn't working, I got hurt at work. I had no outlet, at least as far as I could see. No outlet to deal with the anger, the resentment, everything that I was feeling. So I started drinking heavily. Started with beer, then I joined the wine club because I thought that was classy. You know? Mm-hmm. Another reason why I signed off, I'm not going to wine club members, so are all my neighbors. You know? And that wasn't doing the trick because I got tired of getting up in the middle of the night to go pee, so I switched to hard alcohol. And then it became an everyday waking up to drink, to not feel what I woke up to feel. You know? As soon as you sober up, all those things that you bottled down, that's just there again. You know? So my only way to deal with it was, I don't want to feel that, so let me drink again. So my life really started becoming unmanageable probably 2018, 2017, probably. Got so bad to the point where I got a DUI with both of my kids in the car. You know? Getting wrecked, getting nothing, drove all the way from family barbecue, from Santa Maria all the way to where I lived up in Paso Robles, got pulled over for rolling through a stop sign. It's amazing I made it all the way to Paso Robles because my blood alcohol level was a 0.32. My alcohol choice was between 99 shooters. Because those got me to where I wanted to go as quick as I could get there, you know. Because I was in the habit of going to work, suffering through work. I worked in Santa Maria. get about 4 or 6 of those for my ride home to Paso Robles, then they'd be gone by the time I got there. Pick up my kids from whoever picked them up, go home, get more. That was my life. That was it. It was surviving the next miserable sober moment for the next time I could just numb everything. And then when I got arrested, of course the next day I go over to try and find out what I was charged with, because I don't have a case of it. It was going to be more than just a DUI. They said misdemeanor, child endangerment. I was like, okay, that's a misdemeanor, not a big deal. Go to court and they charged me with felony charge, child endangerment. And when I was arrested right there in court, $100,000 bail, you know, all this stuff, I was going, shit, it has enough trust, it's in the parking garage. You know,
that was my first thought, it wasn't everything else.
You know, it was like, for me, how could this happen? I'm an upstanding citizen of the community. Don't you guys understand? You know, this is a one-time thing. I only rolled through a cop spot. That wasn't that bad. Bought that for about 6 months, and they never dropped the phone. So, I did 6 months on an ankle monitor. So, the way that I convinced myself that I wasn't alcoholic, it was like, I drew a line in the sand. And every time I crossed that line, I just redrew it. I don't know if you guys have done that, but it's like, okay, well, I'm not drinking every day. Okay, that's gone, I'm drinking every day. I'm not hard alcohol. Okay, well, it's not hard alcohol. I'm not to 99 sugars yet, you know. I haven't been to jail yet. I've only been in the drunk tank, not actually an inmate yet, you know. And even that instance, I was on ankle, home detention. I still have not been to jail. My life is still so manageable. I got this. Then about a year later, and a drunken homeless later, I got another DUI, my third. No kids in the car, but I left to go get gas after drinking at home. She's in bed, and I got pulled over to the gas station. My alcohol conduct wasn't as high. It was only like a 0.23. So you see, you know, I don't really have a problem. You know, I managed well. Those were amazing times. That high alcohol level was still not like a, you better, something's wrong here. It was almost like a badge of honor. You know, it's just sad. You know, that's my greatest accomplishment in life is my blood alcohol level. I'm not living life right, that's for sure. So that time, I was already on felony probation. The child endangerment thing. And of course, there was some small shred of hope in me that like they would let me out of the drunk tank and no, you're going directly to jail, don't pass bill. So I went into jail, went to court, and they were like, nope, you're not getting out. You have 180 days to do. And if we see you in court here one more time for DUI, you're looking at 5 years upstate. No county jail. I said, well, that's not fair. I was like, this is just a one-time deal, guys. I promise I'll never do it again. So while I was in jail, I had the opportunity to read a lot. I don't know if any of you have been to jail for any exercise, but there's not a whole lot to do there. So the first month, I was in general population, and I just read. I had an AA book. There was AA meetings in there. I read the whole big book, read the 12 and 12, you know, didn't see my kids until I got out to the honor fund because I didn't want to do that whole glass love thing with them. I thought it would be too hard on them, but in reality it would probably be too hard on me to see them through that glass and have to be faced with it, what I'm putting my kids through. So I didn't see them until I got to the honor fund where I could have like a face-to-face with them, I could see them sit in my lap, hug them, stuff like that. And that was still rough, you know, daughter cried, you know, it was hard. And so I was, after being in jail for 3.5 months, they let me out, and I was like, all right, I got some sobriety under my belt, read these books, I went to the AA meetings, you know, I know where to go. When you're in jail, you're kind of removed from the chaos of your life that you caused. You know, you don't have bills. Others nagging at you, just stop drinking, you know, really with kids, why are you late, don't have a job, it's just you, you know, you don't have to worry about no one else, it's kind of nice to be, you know, well, kind of selfish. So, this one about me, it was kind of a break. So when I got home, my apartment was forced, not being habitated in it for 3.5 months. I was food rising in the fridge. My taste of my life came back and welcomed me home. There you are. Here's your net. Here's your other food. Here's everything you left. Oh, by the way, you don't have a vehicle because that got auctioned off while you were in jail. You don't have a job anymore. You don't have any income. You don't have custody of your kids because on the way out, they said you're going to have to give up custody of your ex-wife or else we're going to go after custody of them. So faced with all this stuff, and I'm trying to pick up the pieces of my manageable life, and I come across one 99 shooter that I had missed in my drinking. And picked that up, went on a walk, held it in my pocket, and was like really having this internal war of whether to throw it away or just say, F it, it's just one. And you know you really don't want to feel the way you're feeling right now. Well, alcohol won. I took that one shot. And that sent me on a 1.5 week out blackout bender where I didn't talk to any of my family. They came out pounding on my door. They said, we know you're drinking again, everything else. At that point, I had, we talk about surrender in here. I had surrendered to the fact that that was how I was going to die. That this is what was going to kill me, and I'm okay with it. You know? And it wasn't until my dad threatened to come down and break down my door that I didn't open it or not. So when he said he was going to come down, I decided to walk around Paso Robles in 180 degree weather for 4 hours, hoping that if he got there, he would go home. Luckily, he loved me enough that he didn't. He waited for me to show up. As soon as I sat down on my couch, going, man, today sucks. I hear a knock on the door, and I don't know what made me open it. All I can think of now, where I'm at, is that was divine intervention. That was God answering what I couldn't do for myself. I opened the door and there he was, saw me disheveled, having a little bit of tremors from not drinking, and he told me to stay at my apartment, told me to eat, and then tried to get me to rehab the next day, you know. Moved back in with my mom down here in Santa Maria, which I don't know if you guys just had to move back in at like 38 years old with your parents. It's really not that cool. You know, so tried to get into rehab. Went to the San Luis Obispo County has a really great drug and alcohol services program. You know, they have an office located in each county. So that was the only point of access for information I knew of. I didn't know anything in San Maria or Santa Barbara County. So I went there, and my mom was in there, and they go, oh, no place is going to accept you. I'm like, well, why not? She goes, there's a warrant out for your arrest. While I was in my 1.5 week blackout bender, my dad decided to call the probation officer and tell him I was drinking and all this other stuff. Didn't get a hold of me, so I had to deal with that and go back to jail again for a couple of days. Which, of course, it's a horrible feeling. You walk back into that jail cell and you're oranges, and then everybody in there goes, Nay, you're bad! Not the welcoming I wanted, you know. Let me just go to my bed and sleep for the next couple days until I get to court, you know. You're number 27 to come back. Yeah, it's real high point in my life right there. But right out, the probation officer was a really good thing. He was trying to get into rehab and all that stuff, so they let me out. Tried to get in cottage. By the time I got insurance sorted out, they told me I was sober for too long and weren't taking. So where do I go now? At that time, I was going to about 8 AA meetings a week, either walking or riding my brother's bike to my mom's house. Going out to Orchid, going out to the Golden Group, you know, all the rest of the Pyramid Group. And my mom was over by Phil Nightingale School, so I was like, I was getting my miles in. You know, I tried doing just the meetings for a couple months without getting a sponsor. I don't know what it was. I was just like, I'm going to go rehab. I'm going to go rehab. You know, I don't want to start anything I can't finish. So, you know, I appreciate the offer for sponsoring me, but I'll hit you guys up when I get out and I'm better, you know. But like always, God has other plans, and they're usually better than mine. So he removed that option of, yeah, probably when I go in there, come out with some shiny paper that says I completed some program, and convince all my friends and family that I'm cured and I'm good to go, you know. So once rehab didn't happen, I had that sponsor, who's my sponsor now, Kevin G, walk up to me and ask me, hey, you're a sponsor. I said, yeah, I don't know how to do this. You know, I don't know if you got too many sponsees, I don't know if you're busy, I don't want to get rejected, I don't know how to do this thing. And he goes, I'll be a sponsor for a while, I've been wanting to. I said, okay, let's do that. So that's the first time I surrendered to this program, was getting a sponsor. Stopped fighting and wanting to do it my way, just how many meetings do I got to go through to so I feel better and stuff than that crap. Because being sober and not working a program is what I feared the most from this. And that was being sober and living life miserable. I was miserable, but I just kind of shrink and I could black out for a little bit. Living life sober and being miserable, I had to feel everything. You gotta show me something better. How am I supposed to live sober with everything I've done, with all this stuff weighing on me? You know, so being in the program and not working an active recovery program is miserable. You know, I'm not learning anything. I'm just coming in, hearing, sharing, going home. That hour of a meeting was my race from the insanity in my head, but then as soon as I leave the meeting, I'd be back in my life and in what was going on in my head, what I was feeling, and everything else. So it was like, how do I take that and apply it to my everyday life? I didn't know because I didn't work any steps, I had taken no action other than just showing up to a meeting. So once we started working the steps with my sponsor, you know, I was pretty broken down, beaten, and ready to do whatever he suggested. So of course step one was pretty easy, you know, admitting I was powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. I didn't have to look too far back in my life to see that it was unmanageable and that I had no power over alcohol. It was pretty obvious, you know. Living at my mom's, ride my bike, make up to my kids, no job, no nothing. Pretty obvious. You know, I wouldn't be in these rooms if I still thought I had a shred of manageable ability to take care of myself. So that was pretty easy stuff to get through. But one of the things that always resonates with me, that has ever since day one, the first time I ever met with my sponsor, he asked me, am I willing to go to any length for my sobriety? And for the first time in my life, I didn't just agree with something and say, yeah, sure, yeah, sounds good. I'm not really there. Like, I wanted to do this. I was broken. I needed an answer. I needed a solution. I needed something. Because all my efforts didn't work. You know, I could never stay sober long enough to make anything manageable other than it just delayed my misery. You know? So I was actually willing to do whatever it takes. You know? And every time I felt like not doing something, I said, Kevin, I'm going to do whatever it takes.
Yes, Kevin, I am.
And I do it, and, you know. Step two, change the belief of power, carry myself to restore my sanity. I didn't think I was insane. So that one, I was like, well, insane, that's a little extreme, you know. I didn't think of myself as crazy, even though my behavior says otherwise. I mean, if you think about it, it is insane how much alcohol becomes such a priority in life that we will give up and disregard our own safety, the safety of our kids, you know, the safety of everybody, and nothing else matters, you know. Our behavior, when you look back on it, is complete insanity, you know. And the whole power grid of myself, I knew there had to be something more than me, because I have not been able to do this by myself, so that would be something. Okay, sure. I can do step two. Step three, when getting into this, I didn't think that it was going to be that big of a deal. You know, I really, my life over to take care of God if we understood him. He was really, because coming into this, I had prayed for God to get me sober. Prayed to get me out of jail. Pray to let me go on a date with that girl. Pray to let me have a lot of food. Pray for them to stop the fireworks. And they were never answered. So when I came into this program, I felt that I was especially how low I felt, depressed I was. I felt I was undeserving of any God that was up there to help me. So he was the last person I was going to turn to and ask for help again. So I didn't really, I was like, you can do this whole 12-step thing without faith, without God. Is it really that necessary? There's a lot of atheists out there. There's a lot of people who don't believe in God, so why is this so necessary? So I kind of believed in the group conscious, so to speak. You know? There was something that made the people in these rooms stay sober. I didn't know what it was, but all of us couldn't do it by ourselves. We had to come together. Something brought us together, something in these rooms. Doesn't have to be the same people. It could be 20 different people the next day, and they're all staying sober. So something in there was what I believed in until, you know, I started practicing faith a little bit more. And faith ended up coming. I started praying at, because my sponsor told me to, you know, started praying for others as opposed to myself. And there was one meeting of our chairman group where it just clicked. Someone had shared and said, you know, God speaks to us through the people in these rooms. And for whatever reason, I know I've heard that before in other meetings, but for whatever reason, I was meant to hear it that day, you know. And it clicked, because I was sitting there waiting for him to text me on my phone saying, hey, Nate, here comes your blessing. Here's your sign from me. This is God, you know, I'm ready to do this. I'm ready to help you now. And I was looking for that direct communication, and I couldn't see what was already in front of me, which was you people sharing your experience, sharing your hope. And now, today, my faith is one of the strongest things that gets me through in my recovery. It's what I rely on in the morning when I pray, it's what I rely on at night when I go to bed. That is my growth. To, you know, I need guidance for him, because if I don't, then I'm running on Nate, and that's not going to end up. Step four, making that searching and fearless moral inventory. I think my sponsor made this step easy on me by not telling me what was coming at the end of it, because he said, just write a column and write names down. I was like, all right, cool. I hate this person. I hate that person. I was like, this is great. I was like, how many, do you have more paper? You know, because I knew a lot of people that I did not like that had wronged me in my life all the way from like second grade. So, this is great. Why didn't you have me do this in step one? Now we're making progress, you know. And then, write the second column. What did they do to you? Yeah, I got this. Then here, here. Third step, what did that affect? Oh, well, that hurt my feelings. That affected my security. That affected this. I was like, all right, that was easy. I don't know why everybody's talking about this inventory stuff. It's like, that's where they went now. This is great. So then the next column, I was like, okay, the fourth column. And he goes, what was your role? I'm all, what? Didn't you read the other three columns? Well, I had nothing to do with it, you know. So he made it real easy for me to be honest without telling me that I was going to be telling on myself, you know. But step four is really where I think this program started clicking, you know, where I stopped feeling less crappy about myself, I guess. I stopped living in the past so much. I started to uncover and deal with some of the stuff that I use alcohol to bury on a daily basis. A lot of anger, a lot of resentment. A lot of things were pointed out and made clear that I wasn't even aware of just by putting it down on paper. So that was step four after going through that. And he did step four and step five in the same thing. Like, we went through this for like a couple hours at the beach after I'd written everything down. And he starts reading step five. He's like, I'm going to tell something to another human being. I was like, I got to tell somebody else about this. So no, we just did that with me. We're just going through it. I'm like, okay, I might have lost a friend if I had to tell somebody else about all this stuff. But the crazy thing is I was as honest as I could be in that moment in time. In that moment where I was in recovery, I was as honest as I could be. And my sobriety date is July 7, 2019. Now, I am not in a different space as I was there. I'm just, I think last week I was with a couple guys going over Drop the Rock, and I shared some stuff that I didn't even share with my sponsor. Because I either wasn't ready for it, wasn't ready to be that honest, So in your recovery, you will go through different phases where you're able to, you know, if you just put a little bit in, you'll get something out of it. When you're ready, come back to it. You know? There's no perfect way of doing this stuff. It's just do it. You know, do it the best way you can at that moment in time. Because if you stick around without plenty of opportunities anywhere, it's going to work.
Step six. Entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. At this point, step four and five really made it abundantly clear what type of person I was. And I didn't like it. You know? Everything, all this imaginary life that I had convinced myself I was deserving to live, and this persona I put in front of people was just completely fake and bullcrap. So when I got to step six, it was like, oh yeah, take everything. I don't want to be any of that person anymore. You know? Which as you go through recovery, you realize there's a lot of defects of character that's kind of like, you know, and you kind of want to hold on to. You know? As long as you're willing to let go of some of that stuff, it's all right. You don't have to be, entirely 100% give up everything, but be willing to try. You know? Step six and step seven were both, you know, I was ready to give up whatever I was in the past. You know, step seven, I'm ready to remove our shortcomings, you know, take all of them. But at that point, I developed a relationship with God. You know, and I asked him for everything. I asked him for help, asked him for, you know, help other people out. So I was ready to let go of a lot of things because I'd seen how much destruction and death had caused in my life, and I didn't want anything to do with that person. The only thing I saw was a new opportunity in this program of recovery. And the only way to not be that person again was to keep doing whatever I'm doing right now. Because so far I haven't been back in jail. You know, so far I haven't drank. So far my relationship with my kids, my family, and even my ex-wife has improved. You know, that was not the way it was before I set foot.
Step eight, may list of all persons we are, and we're going to make amends to them all. This one, there are some people I did not want to make amends to. One of them being my ex-wife. But once I had made that list and started to work on some of them, I think my first one was funny, the resentment list you make, the first people on the top of my amends list are the first three people that I wrote down on my resentment list. I don't know how that happened. The people that I resented the most are the ones I owed the amends to first in my life. You know, it was mom, dad, ex-wife. So my mom was the first one, which was rough because when I was staying at her house, you know, I come back to find some sort of praise for, you know, going to an AA meeting instead of going to the liquor store and getting drunk up all the park. I'd be like, oh, I had a really good meeting today. She's like, oh, that's good. I ain't never worked for you in the past. I still think you need to talk to them. Like, that's me, right? Okay, cool. Thanks for the support. You know? So it was hard to go back to her and not come in with all these resentments and want to point the finger and say, you know, I did this because you did this, you know, just saying, you know, hey, you know, I was wrong, how can I make it right? You know, I was wrong for the way I behaved, but I could have been a better son. And she actually cried, you know, and it was like, it was this moment of relief that, you know, even though I was still inside, I still wanted to point the finger a little bit, I didn't. I acted as if, you know. And to see her and the way she responded, like, you know, I see this is really working for you. It changed a lot. You know, because when we're doing this, then it's hard for us to see change. You know, we're constantly doing the work. We're showing up in meetings, and it seems like life is always still kind of stuck in some way or another. It's hard for us to see the things and the blessings that have happened in our lives because either it doesn't happen when we want it to or something doesn't happen when we want. But we do have blessings every day. You know, the fact that we're in the room today is a huge blessing. You know? And then another one that my dad was another event that hit me hard because he's not one who shows me a lot of emotions. And when I told him that he probably saved my life, and that day when he knocked on my door, he started crying. I've never seen my dad cry. And he said,
I've seen this happen to my brothers, to my dad. I was not going to let this do these issues do. I talked about it in the goosebumps right now. You know? And then I talked to my stepmom that day night, and she said, you don't have to do anything. You being sober right here is what we pray for. And so when we pray for other people to help, like our actions and stuff, we don't realize it, but I think we are the hands and feet of God in here. We do the work, and we are the ones that answer the little prayers that are answered, like faithfully in front of the people. I pray for someone to help or share something, someone else needs, you're supposed to adapt this need to say it, it's done. You've done God's work. You know, it's really amazing. You know, so we got to kind of change our perception, or I had to change our perception of how God was working in my life. You know, it wasn't just exact, all right, bam, here's your blessing, you know, right there in front of you. It's becoming aware of the messages that he's sending to us through you guys and through other people that we interact with our lives. So step 8 and 9 was rough. But a lot of growth, just like step 4. Step 10, continue to take personal inventory and wrong promptly admitted. This is something I do every day, you know, so if I don't like it, if I know I'm wrong, I don't like to be wrong. But when I am, admitting it is even worse than knowing I'm wrong. But we have, it's kind of nice not having resentment to carrying that stuff around. So if we notice that stuff, we notice we're doing something we're doing too wrong, and we take care of it right there, that doesn't necessarily us. You know, I've reacted at one point I had to kind of manage apologies to coworkers for, you know. And it's one of those things that keeps us from just having those resentments built up in us so that we either need to continue healing or blow up at a level and stuff like that. Step 11, stop through prayer and meditation to improve our constant contact with God as we understand Him. I do this every night when I go to bed. You know, I start my day off with prayer, asking for guidance, help me do the next right thing. And at the end of the night, I kind of review my day. What could I have done better? What did I do not so great? You know, it's my opportunity to connect and kind of rehash and see what improvements need to be done in my life. You know, step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, which I carry this message out to all of you and practice these principles in all our prayers. Practicing these principles in all my affairs is the only way I know how to live happy and in serenity in the days that I'm not in these rooms of alcohol tonight. While I'm here, the message is here in my face. I hear it, and I see it, I speak with you, you speak to recovery. But the work really comes when you're away from these rooms. And you don't have another alcoholic around. When you're at work with your crazy coworkers, you don't have the same tools we do. That's where us practicing these principles really comes into play, you know. I don't know, this program has been something more than I ever could have imagined. When I came into here, I just wanted to stop the obsession in my eyes, and I wanted to stop that physical. I mean, it had gone beyond the mental wanting to drink and suppress. It became physical. If I didn't drink, I was shaking. If I wasn't drinking, I felt physically ill. I wanted something to stop that insanity when I had that obsession of needing to wake up and drink anything, you know. That was it. That's all I expected, that's all I wanted. And this program has given me so much more, you know. I rode my bike for 2 years, you know. Then I was able to get a car, and they told me, no, you can't drive it yet for another 6 months because you haven't been in the 24-month DUI program long enough. So I had a car, I couldn't drive, in the, you know, on the street. That I put a breathalyzer in that I still couldn't drive. Paying for a breathalyzer and still not even being able to drive. You know? I can drive without a breathalyzer now. I've gotten off felony probation. I'm going back to get, you know, some custody of my kids. I've got a job that I love. I'm 6 months deep into a relationship that I haven't messed up yet. You know, and these weren't anything I asked for. You know, this was I just wanted to stop doing parenting. I thought I could manage it as long as I could quit drinking. You know, I didn't expect these blessings, and then the people I've met in these rooms to be such, you know, loving friends.
I see Leo giving me the look, so I'm going to end with this. And there's a lot more. Once you get done with the 12 steps, you know, I thought it was over. I was like, what do I do now? So the meeting? Lots of books. Drop the Rock is one I'm going through right now. There's always something out there. So this is from Drop the Rock. Me and a couple of guys are going through it right now. So if it is true that there are only two main emotions in life, love and fear, then all that we don't do out of love, we are doing out of fear. It certainly makes one wonder, doesn't it? In recovery, we must constantly challenge ourselves to see which emotion we are acting from. Am I getting love, or am I acting out of fear, or frozen out of fear? We must constantly examine our motives and be willing to own and name our feelings. For many of us, the unnamed fears and the sense of impending doom haunted us during our active addiction days. Those same feelings, in a more subtle form, may still be active in our lives. The way to get through fear is action, and to ask for help. All right, so thanks for letting me speak tonight, guys. I hope you guys heard something. Welcome, newcomers. You know, keep going back. You know, say, stay long enough till the miracle happens, and if you hear the miracle, it'll surely happen. So, stay with it. Happy birthday.
Let's give Nate another hand, please. Again, thank you for sitting tonight, Nate.